Good evening,
or good afternoon.
It's my distinct pleasure to introduce today's speaker. I wrote a couple things out. It's a great pleasure to welcome back to Swarthmore College a most accomplished recent graduate, Benjamin Gossen, highest honors graduate in history and in German studies. Ben, who is currently a graduate student in history at Harvard University, spent a year as a Fulbright scholar at the Free University Berlin after receiving the 2013 Lang Award for Excellence in Scholarship from the faculty of Swarthmore College. That this was a very prudent decision is confirmed by today's event, because it's a rare undergraduate who has his thesis published by Princeton University Press a couple years after graduating. I could read here actually a rather long list of awards and grants that Ben has received in his very young academic career, but rather than listing all that stuff, I'm gonna just say a couple things about Ben as a person, as a student. I knew him. When we talk here at Swarthmore about respect for and thoughtful engagement with diverse views, I think of Ben as an exemplary practitioner of that ideal. Ben always connected his intellectual gifts with kind interest in other people and with an unwavering dedication to social responsibility. And it was that keen ethical intelligence and helpful personality that was always taking a genuine interest, not just in the Swarthmore College community, but in communities beyond the college campus. Ben is also a great lover of nature and an accomplished mountaineer. And I always loved hearing about the newest mountaineering adventures that you were engaged in when you were a student here, and I hope you do that still. Ben has succeeded in combining his adventurous spirit with his academic endeavors. His Harvard dissertation, entitled The Year of the Earth, 1957-1958, Cold War Science and the Making of Global Consciousness, will take him on an 18-month journey retracing the steps of scientists, explorers, politicians, and journalists of 60 years ago. Ben will do research in archives at universities, research stations in every continent or on every continent, including Argentina, Morocco, India, Japan, Germany, and Australia. Today's talk, while covering substantial geographic expanses, is a little less far-flung, but very topical after some recent events, and it is entitled Researching the Nazis from Swarthmore to Paraguay. Please join me in extending a very warm welcome back to Ben Gossen.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much, Hans Jakob. That's a wonderful introduction. And it's, of course, wonderful to be back here at Swarthmore College. To see so many familiar faces in the crowd and also some new ones is a real joy. I feel like this is a homecoming of sorts, in part because I've given a number of talks before in this particular space. I have a long and fond connection to the Swarthmore College libraries, particularly because of the A. Edward Newton book collecting competition. So some of you have been here for those events, and it's absolutely terrific to be back, particularly on this wonderful day. Thanks also to Pam and Wendy and Chris for inviting me to speak and for organizing the event, and to the History Department, the German Studies section, Peace and Conflict Studies, and to the Swarthmore College Libraries, including the Friends Historical Library and the Swarthmore College Peace Collection, for sponsoring this talk. It's truly a pleasure to be here to talk to you about Chosen Nation, Mennonites in Germany in a Global Era, the title of this book that I first drafted as an undergraduate at Swarthmore College. It's a homecoming not only for me, but also for this particular project, which began right here in this building. And I'd like to give you, in the following 40 minutes or so, a sense of what it was like for me to research this project, to write it, and also to do a little bit of advocacy work, speaking about it and so forth, in the recent months since it's come out. My relationship to the Swarthmore College libraries and to research here on Swarthmore campus goes back quite a long way. This is an image of my very first trip to the Swarthmore College Peace Collection back in 1995. I wasn't the one doing the research at that time. It was my mother, Rachel Waltner Gosen, who was researching her own dissertation on Mennonites, particularly Mennonite women who were conscientious objectors or individuals who were opposed to the United States involvement in the Second World War. This is a picture that was taken on Swarthmore College's campus. I don't remember this particular trip to Swarthmore. In fact, only remember hearing the name Swarthmore College many years later. But this particular trip had a number of significant consequences, one of which was the publication of my mother's dissertation as a book, Women Against the Good War, which is a fabulous book. I commend it to all of you. Perhaps more relevant for our own context is that this connection that she had as a historian to the wonderful collections here at the Swarthmore College Libraries led her to suggest to me one day when I was in high school that I might take a look at Swarthmore College as a place to consider going myself. And so that led me in 2009 to become a student here, where I was involved, like all Swatties, in a variety of eccentric activities, including pillow fights in downtown Philadelphia. I also made many wonderful friends, lots of whom are in the audience today. A shout out to the Swarthmore College grounds crew, including lots of you who I see here. So thanks so much for all the support that you've given me, both in terms of my love of nature and in the nurture that I experienced in your community and in the other sort of communities around Swarthmore College during my time here and then on a number of visits back since my graduation in 2013. Being at Swarthmore College as a student from 2009 to 2013 was an opportunity for me, like all college students, to kind of explore who I was and what I was interested in and what I wanted to become. And one of the things that I didn't really expect was to be kind of pulled back once I was in this this very diverse community in terms of an interest in my home community, a place that I came from, and a place that I was interested in fact in leaving and sort of getting away from during my college years. I come from a small, tightly knit Mennonite community in central and eastern Kansas. It's a relatively religious place. Mennonites are a small, there's about 3 million worldwide today, Christian denomination. Most Mennonites would identify as Protestant and as pacifists. These are sort of Christian pacifists who emphasize humility, simple living, and many of them are closely related in terms of cultural practices to the Amish. So that gives you a little bit of context for the type of community that I came from. Mennonites identify often as being part of a global, worldwide diaspora. Here's a map that was produced by one Mennonite scholar in the 1950s that shows Mennonite migrations from Central Europe. The sort of narrative that I heard growing up about Mennonites was that they had originated in the 16th century Reformation in Europe. Many of them had been persecuted for their beliefs, which included things like adult baptism, refusal to swear oaths, refusal to serve in state militaries, and opposition to state churches. They were interested in having independent congregations. And because of the repression that was meted out against them by both Protestant and Catholic rulers at that time, many of them had spread out across the world, living in predominantly German-speaking communities in places as diverse as Siberia, Manitoba, Paraguay, Brazil, and my own home community in Kansas. Mennonites settled in the Great Plains, primarily coming from Imperial Russia in the late 19th century. This included most members of individuals in my family a few generations back. These were folks who were not interested in serving in the state military when universal conscription was instituted in the Russian Empire in the 1870s, many of them coming to Kansas to farm the newly opened land, which was the way in which many of them became famous. So if you hear about Mennonites in the central part of the United States today, often you hear about them as bringing turkey red wheat and being wheat farmers on the Kansas and Nebraska plains. One thing that was sort of common in the way that I had heard about Mennonitism or Anabaptism growing up was that we, at least my particular branch of the Mennonites, were part of what might be called a kind of German religion. This is a picture of my paternal grandfather, a man named Henry Gosen, who was a minister for most of his life. I knew him as a retired minister, a thoughtful and congenial man who always arrived at church a half hour early and who habitually proclaimed himself a proud Prussian. I thought that this was unusual for an avowed pacifist who had spent his life preaching non-resistance, simplicity, and humility from the pulpit. It was also a little bit incongruous with the fact that our family had left from Prussia to come to the Central Plains of the United States some six generations earlier, and his statements about being a proud Prussian were made a full 60 years after Allied mapmakers had wiped any country known as Prussia from the European map. I also realized just a few minutes ago when putting this, when sort of going through this presentation on my laptop, that he passed away during my first semester when I was at Swarthmore. And so it's sort of coming back to me now, but I'm realizing that this project, which I began during my first year here at Swarthmore, was in part sort of a desire to reconcile myself with his legacy in my life as someone who had been very important and who had passed away, but who had also given me sort of a conundrum or a puzzle in terms of thinking about my own identity. On one hand, I thought of myself as part of a small religious group associated with pacifism, humility, and simplicity, sort of the antithesis of pride and earthly nationality, which is what I associated with Prussia, a country that we often think of as being a militarist nation. These two identities are things that my grandfather held in his own mind and body, and that was a tension that I was interested in exploring. So during my time here at Swarthmore College, I thought about what it would look like to go about developing the tools that would be required in order to excavate this conundrum or this paradox that I had learned to know in my own background in Kansas and through the person of my grandfather. So here are just a few images of some of the many people who I got to know very well when I was here at Swarthmore. I took the opportunity to major in both history and in German studies, disciplines that gave me an opportunity to think historically and also to learn the language that was required to read early Mennonite documents. I also took classes in religious studies and in peace and conflict studies, among other departments, which were all sort of geared towards working at a history of Mennonites and German nationalism, which is how I initially framed the project myself. I did the very first research for this project right here in McCabe Library at the Swarthmore College Peace Collection, the Friends Historical Library, and through the stacks on I think all of the levels. My research was not entirely revolving around this project, as you can see from the picture on the right hand or on the left hand side here. There is a copy I discovered and was very excited about this, along with my roommate Chris Geisler of 4 years, who some of you may know. We discovered or were told by our librarian friends here that there is an original copy of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit in the rare book rooms upstairs. So if you're a Tolkien fan, that is a must see, and we were super excited to find that. But of course, this, despite being a wonderful library, does not have all of the archival records that one would need in order to research a history of Mennonites and German nationalism. So it became very clear that I would also need to do research in other places around the United States, but also around the world. Stop number one was Germany. This is a map of what Germany would have looked like in the late 19th century. You can see that Mennonite communities, which are shaded in dark colors, would have been spread across a variety of national borders. There were three major Mennonite communities in Central and Western Europe in the late 19th century, one in the northeastern side of this map, one in the northwestern side of the map, and one in the southwest. Each of these communities straddled national borders. In the northeast, they would have often spoken both German and Polish. In the northwest, Mennonites would have often spoken German and Dutch. And in the southwest, they often would have spoken both German and French. So in the late 19th century, it was by no means certain that Mennonites were necessarily associated with Germanness. Often they were associated with more regional cultures, or often with some of these other cultures that we might think of as French, Dutch, or Polish. And so it's sort of unusual that this narrative developed relatively recently that Mennonites are fundamentally German, as I had heard as a child. And I was interested in knowing where this idea came from. When I was in Europe, both as an undergraduate here and then the subsequent year as a Fulbright scholar, I was affiliated with a number of institutions of higher education, including the Free University at Berlin, as Hans-Jochen mentioned, and with the University at Freiburg in southern Germany. These were both sort of urban places that were a lot of fun to be a student in and to hang out in. But it turns out that Mennonites, being a predominantly rural culture, at least in Central Europe, were not primarily located in these large cities. And so to do the research that I was interested in, I had to go to more rural spaces, such as this Mennonite stronghold in a very remote town in the Palatinate, a place called Weierhof. This is the largest Mennonite research center in Europe. It's called the Mennonitische Forschungsstelle. It looks very cute in this particular picture, but in fact, it's actually madness if you go inside. This is the archive, the sort of lower level of the archive, where you can see the kinds of papers and books that I was faced with when I showed up here, knowing, you know, sort of spotty German and having a kind of interest in this rather arcane topic. Well, I was able to pour through rare books and rare manuscript collections in a way that was utterly fascinating to me because it gave me a sense of how Mennonites began in the late 19th century to develop this narrative of being German, something that I found terribly surprisingly, very surprising, but also interesting, given the sort of larger context of the formation of the German nation state in the 1870s, about 100 years after the United States itself was formed. One of the things I set out to inquire about was what happened to those Mennonites who remained in Europe when military service was introduced, a time which prompted my own family to leave over the issue of military service because they were pacifists and come to the United States. It turns out that Mennonites who remained behind were often interested in performing military service as a way of integrating, as they saw it, into nationalizing cultures, including German national culture. Here, for example, is a family in the northeastern part of Germany, a place called West Prussia, shortly before the First World War. You can see that they still clearly identify as Mennonite, being oriented around the family Bible, but at the same time, they've adopted the trappings of militarist German nationalism, including things like military uniforms, a sailor uniform for the youngest child, things like mustaches, and even the worldly technology of photography. The other thing that I discovered, having had basically no prior knowledge of something that had been more or less hidden from Mennonite communities, including my own, for some 70 years, was the fact that Mennonites continued to nationalize with the wider culture around them as they remained in Germany. I had not set out to research this particular aspect of European Mennonite history, but it became apparent to me as I was in Europe doing this research that despite the fact that I had grown up thinking of Mennonites as pacifists who could not possibly have anything to do with the radical right or something as heinous, at least as I learned of it as a young person, as Nazism, that was in fact not the case. And a good number of Mennonites in Europe and also in other places around the world during the 1930s and 40s became deeply interested in National Socialism. Just to give you a sense of what that would have looked like, here's an image of Mennonite members of the Waffen-SS hoisting a swastika flag in the largest Mennonite colony in Eastern Europe, a place called Molochna in Ukraine, on the occasion of a visit from Heinrich Himmler, possibly the second most powerful man in the Third Reich at the time during the Second World War and also the main architect of the Holocaust. What shocked me as I got into this research was that there was not merely an interest in Nazism among Mennonites in Europe, but also among groups in other parts of the world. Here, for example, you can see a Mennonite choir performing at a Nazi rally in Winnipeg in Manitoba in 1939. This is extremely late, only a few months before the entry of Britain and Canada into the Second World War. Jumping to yet a third continent, this is an image from the Colony Hall in Fahrenheim, a Mennonite colony in central Paraguay, very removed seemingly both from Europe and also places like Canada and the United States, but this was a place where Mennonites also had an extreme interest in National Socialism. You can see the Nazi slogan, the use of the common good above the good of the individual, slung above a picture of Adolf Hitler hanging in the main administrative building of this Mennonite colony, deep in a relatively rural area, known as the Chaco. As I was doing my research, it became increasingly clear to me that I would have to go visit Paraguay, in part because Paraguay is a totally fascinating place that I had never been to before, but also because it increasingly became apparent to me that Paraguay was in some ways a key to understanding Mennonite interest in Nazism, not only in Latin America, but also in multiple continents around the world. Paraguay was a place that in the 1920s and 30s, Mennonite refugees from around the world began coming. They were given blanket entry rights by the Paraguayan government, including freedom from military service and from oaths, as well as complete judicial and administrative jurisdiction over a large percentage of the Paraguayan state. I had known as Paraguay. I had known of Paraguay since I was relatively young, often hearing about these refugees who had come there to establish what at the time was called a Mennonite state. This was a kind of Zionist-like project that Mennonite leaders in Paraguay, North America, and Europe thought of as a place where individuals who were persecuted, whether in Canada, the Soviet Union, Poland, or elsewhere, would be able to find refuge in times of need. I also learned in the course of my research that in the Paraguayan Mennonite colony of Fernheim in the central Chaco, in the northwest region of the country, around 80% of Mennonites by the late 1930s had signed a document stating that they were willing to settle unconditionally in Hitler's Germany. So a few years ago, I decided that Paraguay was within my sights and that it was necessary to go there to research this project. I flew into Asunción, the capital, which is a place of contrasts like many Latin American cities. You can see here in the distance the relatively wealthy, or at least comparatively wealthy, business, financial, and administrative district of Asunción. In the foreground is one of the largest slums in the country. I got to the Chaco, this region where these Mennonites had settled, by bus. It's about a five-hour bus ride along a route that's called the Trans-Chaco Highway that goes north through the state. And I was interested in particularly finding this area where Mennonites had settled that was inhabited primarily by indigenous folks, members of the Enlet or Lengua tribe, during the late 1920s and early 1930s. At the time, when I was on this bus heading down the Trans-Chaco Highway deep into this remote bush jungle, I thought of myself as in some ways following the footsteps of other travelers who had come to the Mennonite colonies years before, including this individual, Herbert Wilhelmi, who had arrived in the Chaco during the 1930s. I was in some ways quite different than Wilhelmi. He was a geographer, not a historian. He was coming from the University of Kiel in the 1930s rather than from the United States. And he was also traveling with funding from the Nazi Party. Herbert Wilhelmi was interested in finding Mennonites and other German speakers across Latin America and assessing the degree to which they had retained their so-called German customs and way of life. He was also interested in propagating Nazism and Nazi ideals among the Mennonites and other German speakers that he encountered. I first learned to know Wilhelmi in this building. It's called the Foreign Office, and it has a beautiful archival room close to the Spree in Berlin. If you've ever been to Germany's capital, this is just a few steps from the beautiful Museum Island, which you may know is home to plundered treasures such as the Pergamon Altar and the Ishtar Gate, which I at least think of as a testament in some ways to the hubris of fallen German empires. In the 1930s, it was still conceivable, I think, that Hitler's Reich might last 1,000 years, and that's certainly the message that travelers like Wilhelmi brought to the Paraguayan Chaco when they arrived there after their own arduous journey through the bush. It's possible that these were some of the individuals that Wilhelmi talked to on cool evenings as he showed slides of idyllic German landscapes and spoke of the economic prowess and political will of Adolf Hitler. He was interested in bringing Nazism to this colony, and indeed this was a place where Mennonites were unusually receptive to the news of National Socialism brought by individuals like Wilhelmi. The reason for that was that these individuals were themselves refugees who had left from the Soviet Union in the late 1920s. There was a large German-speaking Mennonite population in the Soviet Union, which had come under persecution because they were German-speaking, because they were religious, and because they were, on average, relatively wealthy. Those were, of course, the three strikes against anybody in the Soviet Union to be labeled as a so-called enemy of the people. And many Mennonites were summarily executed, shipped to forced labor camps, or otherwise harassed by the Soviet government. That led to a large effort to leave the Soviet Union by Mennonites. And with the help of the German government in 1929, about 4,000 of these individuals were able to get out of the Soviet Union, which was a deeply unusual event, and were brought to a series of transit camps in northern Germany. While they were there, they learned to become familiar with a rising strand of German nationalism, which was racial German nationalism, the idea that the German people were not merely inheritors of a particular cultural background, literary culture, and language, but that they had something fundamentally German or Aryan in their blood and bone structure. While they were in these transit camps, about 1,000 of these Mennonite refugees were tested by so-called racial anthropologists from the University of Kiel, incidentally the same place that Herbert Wilhelmy was working. They were examined in terms of their pigmentation of their hair and of their skin, and also their bone structure. So there's a robust Mennonite literature, on the size of Mennonite noses that comes out of this particular encounter. If you want to read something very strange, I'd commend that to you. But these scientists would essentially measure the different parts of these Mennonites' bodies, assess the degree to which they had blue eyes and blonde hair, etc., against different color wheels, and also measure parts of their faces and how tall they were. According to these racial scientists, Mennonites, or at least these particular Mennonites in these transit camps in 1929 and 1930, were more Aryan, this was the language used at the time, than the average German. So you can see how someone like Herbert Wilhelmy, who had access to these kinds of studies, would believe that Mennonites in a place like Paraguay were sort of paragons of German or Aryan culture. They seem to have preserved their German way of life even in a relatively hostile environment, when most people around them were speaking indigenous languages like Guarani or colonial languages like Spanish. These Mennonites continued to speak German and produce their German folkways. That, at least, was the narrative that Wilhelmy gave to his hosts, which was quite laudatory. But he also had a number of reservations about the Mennonites in the Paraguayan Chaco, which he shared in a private letter to the German Foreign Office, a letter that I was able to find in that archive when I was in Berlin some years ago. What he wrote was deeply interesting to me and somewhat shocking, because his view of these Mennonites was not as rosy as he had led them to believe. So I have just a few quotes to give you a sense of how a Nazi geographer in the 1930s might have spoken about this diasporic group of Mennonites. There's a few quotes that I'll read you here. These are from Wilhelmy that I've translated into English. The first thing that he said was, "Centuries of isolation and an astounding genealogical tradition have awakened in the Mennonites the notion that they are an independent race or an independent tribe. Everywhere in the world, observers count the Mennonites not among the German racial groups, nor among the Russians or Canadians, but rather consider them members of their own Mennonite nation." He was critical of this idea that they were there to form a Mennonite state. He went on, "The settlers who limit themselves to Mennonite thinking are the ones who years earlier migrated to a remote wilderness to establish an ideal Mennonite state. The group of religious fanatics consider Nazi supporters as being traitors to the Mennonite cause. They consider them to be rebels who would soon lose their Mennonite identity if they were to live scattered among other Germans or Paraguayans." And then, and this is surely the most shocking part to me of the letter, he penned what was at the time the cardinal insult of National Socialist ideology. He classed his hosts as better followers of Abraham than of Hitler. "Jewish history," he wrote, "dominates the Mennonites in all details. Through the giving of Jewish first names, they seek to compare themselves to the Jewish race. Like the Jews, Mennonites believe the bonds of blood make them not just a single race, but the chosen race of God." I found this to be a very curious tension. On one hand, Mennonites were identified, or could be identified, by Nazi scholars as the most Aryan group that there was. In fact, what made scholars like Wilhelmy so interested in Mennonites was the fact that most of them lived not in Germany itself. Only about 13,000 Mennonites lived in Germany when Hitler came to power in 1933. But that of the 500,000 members living worldwide, most of them lived outside of Germany. And despite the fact that they lived outside of Germany and often had for hundreds of years, many of them continued to speak German and to advance German folkways. According to Nazi scholarship produced during the 1930s, Mennonites had a so-called colonial potential, some 14 times greater than that of German Protestants, and an astounding 50 times that of German Catholics. During the 1930s, Mennonites were quite literally the poster children of maintaining Aryan identity outside of German borders. These are two posters from a 1935 film produced by the Nazi Party that was shown widely in Germany. This was a kind of Nazi blockbuster, and it was about Mennonites, a small Mennonite colony in the Soviet Union. You can see how Mennonites were kind of coded in this visual imagery. On the left-hand side, you see the villain of the film, a sort of stereotyped, kind of Semitically coded member of the Red Army, a Red Army captain who's shown in this kind of demonic red communist light. And on the right-hand side, you can see the hero of the film. This is the Mennonite elder or bishop of the congregation, who's shown in these kind of chiseled agrarian Aryan features. The plot of this film, which I found totally fascinating, was that the small Mennonite community in the Soviet Union had lived for generations in peace, basically not interacting with anybody else in the Russian Empire. But with the communist revolution in 1917, they had come under Bolshevik rule and had been suppressed by the Red Army, which was occupying their village. So it's clearly a sort of fight against German Aryan ideals, this German-speaking community, and Bolshevik oppressors. I have just a very short clip from this film, which I'd like to show you. I think it gives you sort of a sense of some of the ambiguities of Mennonites as being depicted by National Socialists during the 1930s. It's about a minute and a half long. Comes from about a third of the way through the film. It's in German, but there are English language subtitles, so hopefully you can follow along. But this will give you a sense of what it would have looked like to see Mennonites on the big screen in 1935 in Nazi Germany. This comes about a third of the way, as I said, through the film, and what's happening in this scene is that the elder or bishop of the congregation, who's on the left, is arguing that Mennonites should retain their traditional pacifism and turn the other cheek and be receptive to these communists who have invaded their village. He's arguing in the scene with the man on the left, who represents the kind of young men of the colony, who's arguing that Mennonites should abandon their historical principle of pacifism and take up arms against their Bolshevik oppressors. I'll play it for you here.
Ungerecht, Klaus Negebel. Du musst nicht immer bloß das tun, was dein rasches Blut und dein ungebäriger Sinn wollen. Deine einzige Richtschnur soll dein Glaube sein. Dein Glaube und die heilige Schrift, die davon kündet. Liebe deinen Nächsten wie dich selbst.
Ja, das steht geschrieben. Aber wer sind meine Nächsten? Meine Frau, meine Verwandten. Und ihr alle, die ihr mit mir eines Blutes seid, die ihr mit mir eine Sprache sprecht. Ihr seid meine Nächsten.
Nein, alle Menschen sind deine Nächsten.
Auch die Russen?
Ja.
Auch die, die uns unsere Pferde gestohlen haben? Die uns berauben? Die unseren Frauen nachstellen?
Ja, auch die.
Dann ist das nicht der rechte Glaube.
Klaus Niegel!
Nein, 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 das ist nicht der rechte Glaube. Das ist nicht mein Glaube.
Es ist unser Glaube. Es ist der Glaube unserer Väter. Da sage ich mich von diesem Glauben los.
So you can see that there was some ambivalence on the part of National Socialists to Mennonites. They were interested often in the racial aspect of the Mennonite church, but were deeply skeptical of Mennonite theology, particularly this historic emphasis on pacifism. When Nazi anthropologists, geographers, linguists, biologists, and other racial scientists fanned out from Germany looking for Mennonite communities in remote deserts, jungles, and prairies, they often came back with relatively mixed reviews. For example, here you can see the opinion of a Nazi anthropologist who visited a Hutterite community in Manitoba. He called them a Christian communist sect. Communists, of course, being the major enemies of the Nazis at this period. This was not a compliment. Nazi anthropologists were often deeply skeptical of very conservative Anabaptists, particularly those who refused to drive automobiles, use electricity, or maintain a so-called living relationship with Germany. When they visited Amish and conservative old colony Mennonites in places like northern Mexico or rural Canada, they called them, quote, probably the strangest, spiritually and culturally insane splinter of the German nation. These individuals, these groups, had ostensibly been ossified, according to these Nazi anthropologists, since before 1800. And one of the charges was that their blood had been weakened and that they had become degenerate, language that was often reserved for individuals who the Nazis were persecuting at this time, particularly the Jews, through so-called pacifist inbreeding. This pacifist inbreeding, this sort of language of of degeneracy because of their faith, according to many Nazi scholars, is what had led many of these conservative Anabaptists to turn their back on the German nation, as these Nazis would have seen it. Of course, they were much more positive about Mennonites who had an active relationship to Germany and were enthusiastic about National Socialism, particularly those in the Fahrenheim colony in Paraguay. So it was very interesting for me to go and meet many of the descendants of these individuals who had met Wilhelmy and other Nazi scholars during the 1930s. Mennonites still live in the Paraguay, in the Chaco in Paraguay today. Many of them remain German-speaking and remain in these relatively closed German-speaking colonies. Here you can see a number of acquaintances and friends of mine outside a German-language Mennonite church in the Paraguayan Chaco. And one of the interesting things is that they continue to maintain a belief that Anabaptism or Mennonitism, at least in the Chaco, is fundamentally a German religion or a religion that comes from a sort of German origin. That's, of course, something that I find to be not quite commensurate with the demographic reality of the Mennonite church today. This is a map that was produced by the Mennonite World Conference 2 years ago that shows the demographic reality of Mennonite congregations across the world in the 21st century. You can see that most Anabaptists, in fact, are individuals of color, often living on current or former mission stations and in evangelized congregations in places like Congo and Ethiopia, in India, and in Indonesia. Even in a place like Paraguay, about two-thirds of the Mennonites, in fact, are not individuals who identify as white or as German-speaking. About a third of them are Latino, and about a third of them are indigenous, including members of the Enlet or Lengua tribe that lived in the land that the first white Mennonite settlers came to in the 1920s. Nevertheless, despite the fact that most Mennonites in Paraguay are individuals of color, the disparities between the economic and social and even religious practices of different members within the Mennonite church in Paraguay are deeply unequal. Here, for example, you can see a shanty town that has been built for displaced persons in Asunción because of flooding of the Paraguayan River in 2016. You would never find a white German-speaking Mennonite living in a place like this. German-speaking Mennonites in Paraguay earn on average about $45,000 a year. That's an enormous sum that goes quite a long way in a place like Paraguay. It's about 8 times the national average and some 80 times that of the average per capita income of indigenous Paraguayans. That posed certainly some ethical issues for me as I was researching in the Paraguayan Chaco. I found that I was often welcomed by these communities, largely because I conformed to what it looked like to be a settler colonist. I spoke the right language, German. I had the right last name. There are lots of Gosens running around the Chaco. And I could practice the right shibboleths and passwords in terms of what it meant to practice Mennonite faith by going to church on Sundays. I knew the right prayers and knew the right foods, things like Sweebach and Varenica that I was familiar with from growing up in central and eastern Kansas. This was a family that took me in. I've stayed with them a couple of times. Their name is Friesen. They are wonderful people. This is a photo that I showed to my class when I was teaching a course on ancestry at Harvard this last semester, and when I was returning from Paraguay after a trip over spring break. And one of the first things that one of my students said was, "You look like you could be a member of their family." And I thought that was really astute because that's precisely the way that it felt. It felt like I was being welcomed by members of a close-knit extended family. That, of course, raised a number of questions for me. What did it mean to be researching the history of white nationalism and Nazism at the same time that I was cashing in on my own cultural privilege? I had a wonderful time in Paraguay as well as in the communities I visited in North America and across Europe, but my access to documents and to communities was often facilitated by my white skin and my cultural privilege as well as sort of underwritten by the labor of local individuals of color. It was also a deeply rewarding time to be traveling and to be researching. I was able to access many documents that would be unavailable to people who didn't look like me, including to women and especially to people of color. I was also able to meet with individuals who had lived through many of the events that I was researching. This is the Colony Administrative Building in Fahrenheim in the Chaco. Just a few feet from this building is a Mennonite retirement home where I met folks like a man named Niklaus Gosen, a feisty conversationalist who's 90 years old but continues to bike about 20 kilometers per day. He was a terrifically interesting person. He shares my last name and undoubtedly a good bit of my DNA. His arm also bears the hallmark tattoo of the Waffen SS. Like many individuals in Paraguay, he was not born in Latin America, but rather in the Mennonite colonies in Eastern Europe. He grew up in the period of the Soviet Union and experienced Nazi occupation during the Second World War, at which time he was considered not, as Herbert Wilhelmy might have classed him, as Semitic, but rather by Nazi occupiers as being fundamentally Aryan. These are drawings done by a Nazi artist named Heinz Hindorf, who visited the Mennonite colonies in 1943, depicting individuals who Niklaus Gosen might have known as a young man. What's important here is not these individuals' names, they have not been preserved in the historical record, but rather the fact that they are portrayed with classic Aryan features. Between 1941 and 1943, the large Mennonite colonies, encompassing some 35,000 individuals located in Ukraine, came under Nazi occupation, where they experienced some of the bloodiest fighting and some of the worst atrocities of the Second World War. Here you can see a map of the Mennonite colonies, which are shaded in black. To the south is the Black Sea, the Sea of Azov is to the right. Crimea, which was annexed by Putin recently, is at the bottom. All of these Mennonite colonies came under Nazi occupation, and because of their experiences under Bolshevism during the previous more than a decade, they had decided to welcome the Nazi occupiers not as invaders, but as liberators from Bolshevism. Here you can see a parade that has gathered to welcome Heinrich Himmler in October of 1942. Niklaus Gosen may be one of the young men in the cavalry squadron organized by the Waffen SS here in the front of the photo. Just to give you a sense of what the Nazi occupation would have looked like for Mennonites in Eastern Europe, during the Second World War, I have two very quick propaganda films that were filmed by Nazi propagandists in these Mennonite colonies. I think they're pretty interesting and give you sort of a sense of what this occupation would have looked like. The first clip comes from the oldest Mennonite colony in Ukraine, which was called Kortitsa. It doesn't have any sound, but I'll narrate it as it goes along. So it opens with a banner, which says, the colony of Kortitsa welcomes the Reich Minister. They're welcoming Alfred Rosenberg, who was the main administrator of the occupied Eastern territories during this period of the Second World War. This is the summer of 1942. And here you can see these Mennonites and other locals arrayed as Alfred Rosenberg and his entourage of Nazi officers comes around the corner. The Mennonites are giving the Hitler salute with lots of swastika flags. This is Johann Epp, who was the Mennonite mayor of Kortitsa. The entire colony included a total of about 19 villages. There's also Ukrainians in traditional dress who are here. And I think that this is the most telling moment of the film. This is a young boy, presumably a Mennonite, who, despite having lived under Nazi occupation for less than a year, knows that when Alfred Rosenberg gives him his hand to shake, he should instead give the Nazi salute. This is the second and final clip, and this comes from the largest Mennonite colony of Molochna, somewhat to the south. This is not of any particular event, but rather a propaganda series that would have been shown in newsreels across the Nazi Empire to show what it would have looked like to live in a allegedly idyllic agrarian colony. Note how peaceful this looks, but also keep in your mind that this was occurring at the same time that there was a brutal total war being waged relatively nearby on the Eastern Front. So here you can see this kind of agrarian setup in the front with the animals. This is a sign that reads Hauptstadt. The colony was renamed Hauptstadt, which was a more German-sounding name from the original Ukrainian Molochna. It's labeled as a German colony. Here is a map of the reorganized colony. It now includes things like a SS barracks. These again are presumably Mennonite children wearing swastika armbands who are pointing out the sort of reorganized structure or layout of this village. And then the remainder of the clip shows them walking into a building which is called the Deutsche Laden, which means the German store. This would have been a segregated grocery store that only German speakers, Mennonites and other German speakers, would have been able to enter. The whole Mennonite colony system was segregated with these kinds of segregated grocery stores, but also theaters and other buildings that would have been accessible to German speakers, but not to their neighbors, including Russian speakers, Ukrainian speakers, and particularly Jews. At the same time that the SS was meting out generous welfare benefits to these Mennonite communities, this same organization was committing genocide on a massive scale, initiating a process that has become known worldwide as the Holocaust. It was in this part of Eastern Europe, in makeshift graves, in secluded barnyards, in ravines, and in urban ghettos, that the SS, through a process of roving killing units known as Einsatzgruppen or task forces, initiated the Holocaust. They would round up Jews, force them to dig mass graves, and shoot them. Others loaded them into gas vans where they were asphyxiated. Other Jews were forced to remove the bodies before they too were killed. About 1.2 million Jews were murdered in Ukraine during 1941 and 1942. That was about 98% of the local Jewish population. Only 2% survived the war. These statistics can be given in marked contrast to the fate of Mennonites in Eastern Europe during the Second World War, who were treated as members of the racial Aryan elite by the occupying National Socialists. And even when the war began to go very badly for the Nazis on the Eastern Front, especially following the loss at Stalingrad in 1943, as the Wehrmacht retreated, it was decided by the SS and military leaders to bring virtually all of these Mennonites who had remained in this part of Europe with the retreating army. So virtually all 35,000 of these Mennonites accompanied the Waffen-SS and the Wehrmacht westward out of Ukraine, often being resettled in camps in occupied Poland or in Germany itself. Just as the military was pushed westward by the Red Army in 1943, the Red Army continued to advance during the spring of 1945, and by May, Hitler was dead and Germany had surrendered completely and unconditionally. This left, however, a problem for these thousands of Mennonite refugees, many of which had actively identified as German during the war. Because of their collaboration with National Socialism, they were due for repatriation or forcible return to the Soviet Union. In the minds of many of these individuals, that meant clearly that they would experience sexual assault, perhaps summary execution, and certainly years, in the best case scenario, of hard labor in Siberian gulags. That meant that many of them fled westward into parts of Western Germany that were occupied not by the Soviets, but especially by the British and the Americans. There they were gathered into refugee camps by a North American Mennonite organization called the Mennonite Central Committee, based actually here in Pennsylvania, which claimed, along with many of these refugee charges, that these Mennonites were not German, but in fact members of their own Mennonite nation, that had not collaborated with the Nazis, but in fact had been persecuted during the war like the Jews. Mennonite Central Committee printed thousands of these so-called Mennonite passports that claimed that the Mennonites were of so-called Dutch origin, which then allowed many of these individuals, despite prohibitions on giving exit visas to individuals who had identified as German during the war, these sort of claims of Mennonite ethnicity or Dutch nationality allowed a majority of these refugees who arrived in Mennonite Central Committee camps to leave on transportation vessels funded by the United Nations, which went to places like Canada and to Paraguay. This is a story, then, not only of collaboration with National Socialism, but also the cover-up of this widespread collaboration by prominent Mennonite institutions on both sides of the Atlantic. It's a story that has not surfaced in any substantive public way in multiple countries for around 70 years. And in fact, the first public discussions of this in a sort of sustained way across national borders only began occurring in 2015. And so it was in the middle of researching this project that there became this broad public interest in the history of Mennonites and National Socialism, and it's been one of my privileges to be part of that process of uncovery. This is an image of the very first conference, which was held by the German Mennonite Historical Society about Mennonites and Nazism in 2015 in the city of Münster. You can see on the right-hand side the president of the Historical Society welcoming guests who were coming from multiple continents to discuss this important history. The second such conference occurred this past March in Paraguay. Here you can see attendees gathering outside of the conference building during a coffee break. And this conference was about Mennonites and fascism in Latin America. These two initial conferences will be followed by a third one, which is going to be in Kansas. It's sponsored by Mennonite Church USA, which is the largest governing body of Mennonites in the United States. And this topic is going to focus, unlike the previous conferences, which were primarily about Mennonite experiences under Nazism, on the experiences of those who suffered under Nazism. This conference is on Mennonites and the Holocaust, and it's going to be held March 16th and 17th. So certainly an event that you can follow along with if you're interested in learning more. This topic, of course, is not only of interest to the Mennonite Church, but also of broader interest to those who are concerned with the rise of white nationalism, including neo-Nazi and KKK movements in the United States and beyond. We're currently living in the largest resurgence of right-wing nationalism on a transnational scale since the end of the Second World War, as revealed most notably by the Unite the Right rally at Charlottesville, Virginia, 3 weeks ago. This is a topic that I have come to understand, sadly, is not merely relegated to history, but also one that has ongoing relevance for my denomination, for the wider U.S. society, and also for world politics, economics, and society. It's one that I think behoove all of us to think about, and certainly one that I am interested in continuing to address in the following weeks and months. So that's my presentation. Thanks so much for listening, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.